Welcome back, Vertical Podcast, Chris Mannix, Yahoo Sports, episode 2 of the Vertical Podcast, and we got a good one for you here today. Former Oklahoma City Thunder head coach Scott Brooks, he's going to join the program, and we're going to talk some more coaching changes. Derek Fisher, he's out in New York. George Karl, could he be right behind him in Sacramento? All that and more on the Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix.
Yahoo Sports presents the Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix. Powered by digital media. Find your voice. And now, your host, Chris Mannix.
All right, welcome back. Vertical Podcast, Chris Mannix. Let's jump right in. Let's bring in Scott Brooks, former Oklahoma City Thunder head coach, 10-year NBA veteran, NBA champion, all sorts of good stuff. But Scott, let me ask you this. If you could describe yourself as a player, put an adjective in front of your name, in one word, what word would you use?
Jeez. Tough question to start the conversation.
That's how we roll here, Scotty.
Jeez. Can I just put two words?
Sure.
Very lucky.
See, I'd go with, like, you were like the undersized white guy. I'd go with, like, feisty, scrappy.
I would say scrappy. I mean, I had to be a scrappy player. I was 5'11". Wasn't the most athletic guy, but, you know, I knew the game very well. I studied the game. I loved the game. I was passionate about it. But I was lucky. I mean, it's not a, there was only 23 teams back then, 275 players. So it was a hard league to make, and there was not 15 guys on your roster. But I got blessed with being around a bunch of great coaches early on and taught me the game of basketball.
Your best moment as a player?
When Jimmy Lynam told me my rookie year that I made the team. That gave me...
Okay, that's just sad on every level. I mean, that's your crowning achievement as an NBA player?
Chris, do you know how hard it is to make the NBA?
Yes, I mean,
there's
do.
Millions. I mean, you can do it, right?
No, of course not. I could barely get out of high school basketball.
It was so hard to make it. And, you know, when I made the team, Charles Barkley brought me in and said, hey, you want a room with me for a couple of months? I said, are you kidding me? I'm 22, 23 years old. I'm room with Charles Barkley. I made the Philadelphia 76ers. That was probably the best moment. And then obviously winning the championship with Houston, Coach Rudy T and Olajuwon. It was just a great run we had there. And winning the championship, beating the New York Knicks was a great thrill for myself and my career. That's one thing they could never take from me. I would never say I was a great player. I survived by just playing tough, being a great teammate, but I will always be known as a 1994 world champion.
What was living with Barkley like?
You know, the crazy thing is, he was so generous. He had me live with him. I thought he was just being a great guy, and he was. I mean, I was driving his Mercedes and his Porsche, but I had to drive him around. I had to go pick up. I was like his Uber driver, and I had to go pick up his meals for pregame. But he's great. He's a neat freak. His house was immaculate. He was very gracious. But the reason why he did that, because he didn't think I was going to make the team long term. And I was about to sign a 6-month lease in Philadelphia. And the guaranteed date was like December 23rd. And he brought me in and said, hey, just stay at my house for a couple of months. It'd be great. But he really did. He didn't want me to get a lease because he didn't think I was going to make the team.
Did you have like a, I'm picturing you with like a twin size bed, you know, in like a back bedroom that Barkley used as a closet prior to your arrival? Am I close?
Well, he had more floors than I can ever imagine having a house that big. It was a big 3-story house, but it was great. He was fun. You know what? He was one of my best teammates I've ever had. He was so generous. I remember one day after practice, we're driving home, and we're not going on the usual route. I'm like, okay, where are we going? I'm 22, 23 years old. I'm in awe. I'm playing with the Sixers. I'm hanging with Charles Barkley. He's like a 5-time All-Star at that point. He tells me, make a left, make a right, make a left, make a right. And we finally hit this grocery store, and he says, grab a basket. And, you know, he's not just saying grab a basket. He's using a bunch of adjectives. So I'm grabbing the basket. We're filling this basket. He's filling his basket. We got so much groceries, we can live for a year. So I'm thinking, man, he does. It's living up to his name, the Round Mound of Rebound. So we fill up his car full of groceries, and then we're headed to his house. But we're not going to his house. We stop at this underpass, and all of a sudden, there must have been 30 or 40 homeless people just running towards the car, and we're handing out grocery bags. And from that point on, I realized the game is much bigger than a game of basketball. It's about impacting people. And he did that so many times. They knew when his car pulled up, they came and he just supported them with groceries and what have you.
Okay, but here's the real question. Who picked up more women, you or Charles Barkley?
Let me just help you with that question. Who averaged more points? He was an all-star. He was like 28 points and 20 rebounds every given. I was a scrub. I was a backup point guard to Maurice Cheeks, which I loved. What a great guy and what a great mentor it was to be under him. But, yeah, Charles had a way with the ladies love Charles.
Okay, but did you ever tell women that Barkley's house was your house?
I can't say I did that. I cannot say I did that.
Can you say you didn't? Can you say you didn't?
What's that term that people use? I can't confirm or
can't deny. You mentioned the Houston teams you played on, and some interesting teammates there. None, I think, more interesting than maybe Vernon Maxwell. Scale of 1 to 10, how crazy was Vernon Maxwell?
12, but you know what? One of my best teammates ever. He laid it on the line every night. You knew 7:30 at night, he was giving everything he had to his team. I mean, he gave everything he had. He was so determined to have success on the court, and just he was feisty. He was athletic. He could shoot. He wasn't afraid of the moment. Great teammate. Just amazing player. I mean, it's one of those guys that if he would have had a break here and there, he probably could have been an all-star.
Wackiest thing you saw Vernon Maxwell do?
The wackiest thing, I remember one game, I think it was against Milwaukee Bucks. I forget the guy's name. I think he played at Arkansas. Maybe, is it Day? So I think that's his name. He threw an elbow at him.
Todd Day.
Yes, I think that's it. I'm pretty sure. It might not, but I'm pretty sure it was him. He threw an elbow at Vernon, and it was like in the middle of the second quarter, and he just checks himself out, walks across our bench, walks on the baseline, walks across the other side of our bench, goes into the locker room. I'm like, oh, my God, where's he going? We still have like 6 minutes to play. Coach Rudy's looking at him like, oh, my God, what's going on with Mad Max here? So we go to halftime. We go to halftime, and we're ready to make our adjustments. All we see is Vernon. He's always dressed nice. He's in his suit. He's already showered. He's in his suit. He's walking out. And Coach Rudy said, hey, Vernon, where are you going? Where are you going, Coach? If you want to play me tonight, you're going to have to get me out of jail because I'm going to knock that guy out for what he did to me. And so Coach Rudy said, okay, I'll see you tomorrow at practice.
did he go after him? Did he?
No, he left. We let him go home. He went home, and he didn't go in the second half.
Oh, God.
But, yeah, he would have went after him. He was that crazy. But, great, like I said, a great teammate.
The big question, you mentioned you were part of that team that won a championship in the mid-90s. The question that people always have about those Rockets teams, would they have beaten Michael's Bulls team that during the years that Michael went on hiatus? Would that Rockets team have beaten the Bulls?
Well, it's easy for me to say yes because obviously I'm biased and we never had to play them. But I will say before he retired, they always struggled with us. We beat them up their place. We beat them at our place. And even the games we lost, they always came down to the last minutes of the game. But you know, Coach Rudy was like ahead of his time. We were a space offense, obviously with Olajuwon, the best post player in that generation and maybe since then. So we had he surrounded them with a lot of great 3-point shooters. We shot a lot of threes, but we had Olajuwon that they couldn't stop. Their bigs could not stop them, and they would double team, and we would get a lot of threes. But it would have been a great series.
Did you ever defend Michael Jordan?
A few times I had to switch. And I learned very quickly the word help. And I used that word quickly with him and then Magic. Magic Johnson, the people, I don't get it. He has to be top 2, 3, maybe even 1, arguably one of the best players ever. You will never see a player like Magic Johnson ever again. A 6'9 point guard to be able to do that. You're going to see great scorers. You're going to see great 3-point shooters, but I don't think you'll ever, at least in my lifetime, we'll never see a 6'9 point guard that can dominate every area of the game.
Can LeBron, Scott do the things that Magic could do? I mean, how do they compare skill set wise?
Well, I mean, skill set, definitely he's up there, but Magic was a point guard. He ran the show from day one. I mean, it's well documented his rookie year playing all five positions, but he came in as a point guard and he left as a point guard. I mean, if LeBron focused on just being a point guard and ran the team, I'm sure there's going to be a lot of similarities, but Magic is special. I mean, plus the generation, that the 80s basketball, I don't know if you can ever get to that level again. It's just the pure game of basketball. It's just everybody was just playing so hard, laying it on the line every night, and the passing was terrific, and the playmaking. There were so many. It seems like there was so many more two-way players then.
You played in an era where it seemed like the NBA was at the apex or close to it of its physicality. You had, you know, the 80s were obviously physical, but then Pat Riley comes along and, you know, with those Knicks teams and then Miami and played a physical brand of basketball. You subsequently coached in an era where the NBA's tried to remove a lot of that from it. I mean, which brand of basketball do you prefer?
Well, I like the brand of basketball now. It was getting too physical. A guy like Derek Harper.
Yeah.
Derek Harper was such a strong point guard, and I'm 170 pounds, and he hand-checked me, put that right hand on my hip, and he says, no, you're not going to the left side of the court. You're going to go to the right side of the court this time. Oh, no, you're coming back over here. I mean, it was that style. But now it's more free-flowing. Aesthetically, it's a better-looking game. I'm not one of those guys, and, you know, we're better basketball players back then. I think there's great players on all eras, and I think they can be great on any team, but I like the free-flowing game the way it's played now.
Jeez, just hit the weight room, Scott. Come on.
I did.
Come on, did. Bulk up. Don't let Ron Harper push you around.
We left in high school back in 1980.
Let Ron Harper push you around? Man up.
No, Derek Harper.
Derek Harper, sorry. Well, I think that's kind of comparable.
Ron would have done the same thing to me also.
Doesn't matter which Harper, they both would have shoved you around back then, right?
Yeah.
you have, and I want to make sure I get this story right, but you have one of the great, is it correct to say that you're part of the reason that the NBA trade deadline is at 3 p.m. now instead of middle of the game or whenever on a Thursday?
Absolutely. Way to bring up a tough memory.
That's not that tough. You told that story couple of times.
It sucks being fired. I got nothing to do right now. Maybe I should call Woj, try to take your job.
Wow. We're getting personal here, huh? We're getting personal. No, but it's a funny, you know.
Funny getting traded in the middle of a game? That's funny? That's funny to you, huh?
I thought you kind of got a chuckle out of it the time you told
it
before.
It was. You know, now looking back, it is funny.
It's not funny.
I remember the trade deadline, it was like, 8 or 9 o'clock Eastern time, which Central time we were playing in Houston. The game was probably 7:30. And I remember in the middle of the first quarter, my wife gives me the thumbs up. You know, I survived another trade deadline, and we're excited because we loved Houston. It's a great city, and we got great friends, and we just won a championship there. And we go to halftime. We listen to Rudy T's adjustments. We come back at halftime. I shoot a layup. I get ready to shoot my next layup, and all of a sudden, the general manager, Bob Weinhauer, grabs me and says, we got to talk to you. And then he says, you just been traded. And I said, are you kidding me? And yada, yada, yada. And I go home. I'm traded to Dallas and was teammates of Jason Kidd. So, I mean, it all worked out. It all worked out.
Teammates of Jason Kidd. How was defending Kidd in those early days?
He is so good. And I'm glad he gets a lot of credit for being the leader and being a great player. He practiced hard. He improved his game as the years went along. His jump shot is became very, very respectful. He became a great three-point shooter, but just his knowledge of the game, his passion, he practiced hard. It was like, it was never a day off for me because every practice, he was young, and, you know, he wanted to practice. He used practice as a game, and so it was competing against him wasn't an easy thing to do, but it gave me a great opportunity to see greatness at a young age.
Is there ever a time when you're happy to get traded? I mean, is it always like, oh, damn, that just happened?
Well, when I got traded to Philadelphia, I loved Minnesota, but I knew the team was a ways from competing, and I had a chance to play with one of the greatest centers of all time in his prime with Olajuwon. So that was a good moment for me. I was excited about going down to Houston and playing with the Rockets.
When you're playing and you're going through all these transactions, moving around, at what point does coaching start to occur to you? When do you start thinking, you know, all right, when this playing thing is, when I'm done here, I'm going to move on to that next level?
Well, let me just tell you this. Playing is the greatest job in the world. It is such a great job, and it is, I don't even know if you call it a job, but it is a job. But it goes fast. I mean, it goes by fast. I played over a decade of playing, plus minor league basketball. But coaching compared to it, coaching stinks compared to playing. Playing, it's so fun to be out there, the physicality of the game, the competition, the game imbalance. But I knew early on that I wanted to get into coaching, and I was fortunate enough. And this is the best thing about being traded and playing for seven teams or so, is the being able to see different systems and being able to watch different coaches react in the season. Because there's no matter how good you are, you're going to have opportunities to make great decisions or not so good decisions. And I've had a chance to do that with a lot of organizations, a lot of coaches, and being around a lot of great assistant coaches really impacted my way I think of the game.
Your greatest coaching influence was who?
I would say my mom. Seeing her wake up every day, she raised seven kids on her own, no support from my father, left when I was two, and I'm the youngest of seven. Just seeing her get up every day, she never had an excuse. There was never a sick day. Like she would always say, we can't afford to have a sick day. Nobody's going to just give us guaranteed money. She never understood the guarantee contracts. I'm glad she was never a general manager, because I would have never got a guarantee contract. But she was impacting me in major ways, and still does, even though she is no longer with us.
Youngest of seven, what kind of beatings did you take as a kid?
Oh, trust me. I had three older brothers, and they tortured me. They picked on me constantly. But hey, it ended up working out. It made me a tough mentally, and you had to fight back. If you didn't fight back, you weren't going to eat many meals.
So as a player, though, I mean, when you're into coaching and you're learning, I don't know, what kind of system you're going to run as a coach, where do you take and what have you taken from the most?
Which coach?
Yeah, which coach, system? Which system he runs? You know, what was the influences there?
I've taken more concepts through all the coaches, and I really believe to be a good coach, you have to be able to have the ability to empower your team. You have to have a system that they believe in. And there's many ways to win in this league, and there's many ways to develop players, but to whatever way you choose, you have to have your players buy in. And I really believe that I've been around a lot of great coaches and different systems and a lot of success on different styles. And so I've tried to really take away all the concepts that I've learned. For instance, Rudy Tomjanovich really done a great job with spacing and post play. But now the post players aren't as good now. I mean, you want your post players, as the defensive coach, you want that shot. It's like a 38% to 40% shot. There's not a lot of good post players. So I kind of took from that, like, because I know with Houston, when teams double-teamed Olajuwon, it gave myself and Matt Bullard and Vernon Maxwell and Kenny Smith wide-open threes. When they didn't double, we struggled for points. So it kind of really impacted me that way. But there's so many ways to coach.
You know, I gave you credit for being a 10-year NBA veteran. I forgot to include your one-plus-year stint with the Los Angeles Stars.
Well, and 1 year with the Albany Patroons.
That's right.
Under Coach Musselman. We were 48-6, won a CBA championship. And that was back when, like I said, there was only 23 NBA teams with 11 or 12 per team. So basically the CBA, the 10 or 12 teams in the CBA, were now would be NBA players. So very competitive. Playing, I learned a lot of great lessons as a player, and I learned, watched a lot of great players perform, and had a lot of great teammates.
Do you have your CBA championship ring still?
I have my CBA. I have my NBA championship ring, yes.
Which is more important to you?
Oh, they both are, because the CBA gave me my chance. I never went into the game looking to make money. I went into the game because I loved the game. I mean, my first CBA contract was $6,200 for the year. And that didn't include, you had to pay for your own living expenses. I was living at the Quality Inn for 6 months, but loved it. Loved it. Michael Ray Richardson was my teammate. Sidney Lowe was a teammate. Tony Campbell was a teammate. We had a great coach in Coach Musselman. Demanding, tough, crazy at times, but really a good coach.
Compare the value of the CBA championship ring and the NBA championship ring. Monetary value.
I don't know. Maybe I need to go on eBay. But right now, I'm pretty good right now. I don't think I have to do that. But they both will never, ever be sold. And I love them both, and there will be always held dearly to me. They mean everything to me.
You had you mentioned being traded, you know, sucks, being fired sucks. You had your first experience being let go as a coach. Was it as bad as you kind of anticipated? What was the aftermath like for you when Oklahoma City let you go?
You know, Chris, it was disappointing. It was really disappointing. I thought my staff did a great job. Last season, I mean, we still ended up, I think, top five in scoring. You know, the last 5 years I was there, we were always between 3 and 5 in scoring. Defensive field goal percentage, we're always between, you know, 2 and 5 in the last 5 years. I think last year we dipped down to, I think we were 8th in the league in defensive field goal percentage. But it was disappointing. We had a lot of injuries, but I'm proud of our guys. They never used it as an excuse. I mean, we had a tough break 3 years ago with Russell, going down in the first game in the playoffs. And then the next year we had another tough break with Serge going down against the Spurs in the conference finals. But I can't complain. We had a great run. Sam and the ownership gave me a great opportunity. I'm disappointed that I did not see it fulfill of what our goal was, winning the championship. I really believed in my heart going into last season that we were going to win a championship. I thought we had the right amount of experience and also the right amount of just tough luck the couple of years prior to that. And I think you kind of need that to have an edge. We went to the finals as the youngest team in the NBA, and then we didn't have the chance to bring it back, the same group with the trade, with the Harden trade. But we still rallied around with great leadership with Nick Collison and Kevin Durant, Russell Westbrook, and Perk. They all did a great job of putting us back to where we need to be a competitive team.
You know, that Harden trade, it's one of the great what-ifs, you know, that people still talk about to this day. You know, what if Harden had not been traded, those three players kept together, what would have happened? In some ways, it would have fallen on you, Scott, because it would have been incumbent on you if Harden was re-signed to whatever deal to make it all work together. Do you think that if those three guys came back under multi-year contracts, that you could have kept everybody happy, that they all would have been happy playing together?
Well, I think that's an easy question. I mean, you look at all the great teams. Just the Golden State Warriors have 3 All-Stars. Miami Heat had 3 All-Stars. Boston Celtics have 3 All-Stars. The Houston Rockets, when I played, only had 1 All-Star. I got screwed. I didn't get the All-Star bid that year, but Olajuwon was an All-Star.
Totally screwed. I mean, I would have voted for you.
No, you know what? It's easy to say, but it didn't happen. It's all hypothetical. You know, James is a great player. The thing that I love about James, he loved his role. He loved coming off the bench. He loved working with that second unit. Him and Nick had a great bond on the court and off the court. And when James made the USA basketball, he knew that he belonged. And that following year, before he was traded, he was one of our best players. And he did not want to start. You know, we tried to start him a few times because Pablo Cefalosha got hurt. I think I started him like 2 games, and he came to me after each game, coach, please, get me back in my role. I like the second unit. And that says a lot about him because he was a great player. I mean, he is a great player. But I think it didn't work out for whatever reason. They couldn't get it done. We moved on as a team. It was tough. I thought our guys did a great job of picking up the pieces. Mentally, we were drained when it first happened. But I thought my staff and our team did a great job of showing leadership and fighting on, and we ended up winning 60 games that year.
Did James have a different temperament than, say, a Reggie Jackson? Because part of the reason Reggie is now a member of the Detroit Pistons is because he wanted to be a starter. He wanted something, and he said this publicly, he wanted to have a bigger role. Is there a difference in the temperament of the players?
Yes, I mean, absolutely. I mean, you have to have guys that want to be with the program. No matter how good of an organization you are, no matter how good of a coaching staff you have and teammates you have, the guys have to want to be there. You know, Reggie was a great player. For whatever reason, Sam could not get that done. But Reggie wanted to be a starting point guard. He was never going to start as a point guard. Russell Westbrook is the most complete basketball player in the NBA, hands down. And you're not going to be able to take his spot. And I told Reggie that many times, but he was going to have an impact with the play. Reggie's a great player. He can finish around the rim as well as anybody. He's really, give him credit, he's really developed into a solid three-point shooter, and his game management has improved during all the times that he had with our group and being developed day in and day out. Part of being a developing program it's not just the minutes. And a lot of people kind of mess this up, I think. They look at the minutes. Well, he's playing 25 minutes. Well, he's playing 35 minutes. He must be really developing. He's playing 10 more minutes. Developing a player, I looked at it as you develop a player to be a professional basketball player. And that includes being on time. That includes getting your work done early before practice. That includes going hard during practice, film room, shoot-arounds, training room, massages, eyes, stretching, weights. There's so many components that it takes to develop a team, develop a player. And I thought my staff did a great job of doing that. I mean, Kevin Durant, MVP as a 24-year-old. Russell Westbrook, like I said. I think Kevin right now, and I thought he was last year before he got hurt, he was going to be the best two-way player in the game. And I think this year he's the best two-way player in the game. And he's kind of like a forgotten MVP candidate. And the thing with Russell and Kevin, they have two of them on the same team.
Gut feeling for you, and I know it's an impossible question, but gut feeling. What does Kevin Durant want to do with his career after the season?
I mean, that's an impossible question. I do have a great relationship. I still communicate with them through text. I mean, that's the craziest thing. You talk to these players, and it's always through a text. I don't even know if Kevin would know what a phone call ring sound would sound like.
No, texting and social media.
I mean, I could text him, and he texts me right away, and we communicate. We had some great communications the last, month or so. The thing that I love about Kevin, and you know what, with Russell and Kevin, there's only like a handful. I don't know the exact number, but I would say probably under 10, maybe 5 or 6 in the entire league that every team, all 30 teams would want those players. And Kevin and Russell, all 30 teams will take those guys in a second. Kevin's special. He's a special person. He's a gifted player. He's very sincere. He's genuine. When he says that, you know what, I want to get better every day, he's not just doing that. That's not just player talk. That is really what he does. I was able to see that every day. We would practice at 11. Russell and Kevin would be there at 9:15 getting shots up on the court before the even practice even began. And it was good. Kevin's looking for trust. He wants to have a staff that he knows that he can trust. And I thought my staff did a great job with that. He knew that we had his back, and that wasn't just if he hit a big shot. If he missed a big shot, it was always going to be, it's all right, we're going to get this thing together the next game. But he's going to have a great opportunity, and I just want what's best for Kevin, and what's best for Kevin is the right thing.
Knowing what you know about how close this team was to maybe winning a championship, even in the ridiculously tough Western Conference. When you're getting let go and you know what's coming, do you fight back? Do you try to convince otherwise? Or you just sort of have to accept that this is kind of the direction they want to go?
No, you know what? I was disappointed. I was told I was fired. Sam told me, nope, I don't want you back. I just got up. I shook his hand and said, thank you. And I walked out. There was no reason to try to change their mind. I know the group that we had was very resilient. Their players were resilient. And I know myself and my staff are resilient. I was worried about my staff. I was, they were going to be told that they don't have a job. And when you don't have a job, your family is impacted. We have to find schools for our kids, and everything has changed. But I respect Sam's decision. I mean, he makes that decision, and I respect it. I have nothing but good feelings towards their organization. They gave me a great chance to develop. And I think as a coach, you have a choice to make. I think every player has unique talents and unique strengths. And as a coach, you have to be able to take those talents and strengths and embrace them and celebrate them and find ways to get them better. And I think we did that. Or then you have a choice to tolerate it. And I chose not to tolerate our guys' talent. I chose to really embrace everybody's skill. And, of course, you like two-way players at every position. But, we didn't have that. But we utilized what their strengths was. Like Andre Roberson, a great kid. He's a great defender. Improving outside shooter. It's going to take him some time. But we still found ways to make it successful.
Do you have the itch to get back in? Have you felt... some coaches badly want to get back in. Some are happy, like the Jeff Van Gundys and others of the world doing TV and taking a step back. What's been your feeling these last few months?
Well, I think I'm going to try to be the first American Ninja Warrior to win it without a six-pack.
Wow, that's a goal. That's impressive.
I'm going to be the first one. I mean, what do you think?
You know, you've got all this free time. You could try to get a six-pack.
If I compete against you and all the other media guys, I think I might have a chance.
Well, none of us have six-packs either. So,
well, then that's why I'm saying it's a level playing field.
Look, but you've got all this time. You're in Newport Beach. You're in California. I mean, come on, man. You can get yourself a six-pack.
I've been busy,
what,
Chris.
What, with Zumba class?
Hot yoga.
Hot yoga. Okay.
You
Californians, how you
I
roll?
I love coaching. I love developing guys, and I believe in what's right, and I don't know where it's going to be, but I think I love the game. I love being around players. I love coaching them. I love being with a good organization and good players like Kevin and Russell, Nick and Perk. They wanted to be coached hard, and we coached the heck out of them.
Well, Scott, I appreciate the time, my friend. Nice trip down memory lane there. I'm going to ask Barkley about that time in his house right next time I see him. I mean, I bet you're holding back a little bit.
I'm holding back. I'm keeping it PG, Chris.
Well, I appreciate it, Scott. Thanks for taking the time to join the podcast, and we'll catch up real soon.
All right, man. Thanks for having me.
You're listening to the Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix.
Welcome back, Vertical Podcast, Chris Mannix. Before I go, I want to weigh in on a couple of coaching situations that have been developing over the last couple of days. And I want to begin in New York, where on Monday the Knicks decided to fire head coach Derek Fisher. Now, the NBA, it's a results-oriented business, and if the coach isn't getting the job done, chances are he's the first one out the door. Can't fire the players, always going to be the coach. But to me, it was a little surprising that Derek Fisher was let go, just because he was Phil Jackson's guy. I know he was Phil's guy after Steve Kerr was Phil's guy. Steve was the first choice for Jackson, elected to take the job at Golden State over a year ago. Worked out pretty well for him. But I do think that Derek Fisher, and did think that Derek Fisher, was going to be given at least 2, maybe 3 years to get this thing right. But listening to Phil Jackson talk on Monday and the things that he said, it made me believe there were underlying issues with Derek Fisher that went beyond just the X's and O's of coaching. By that I mean, I don't think it was just Phil Jackson being upset with Derek Fisher with the way he coached that team. I think it was more than that. I think he looked at a couple of things. I think he looked at that Matt Barnes situation and didn't like that, didn't like the look that gave Fisher or the organization. And as Phil mentioned during his press conference, he said, look, I don't think Derek Fisher took advantage enough of the elder assistants on his staff, talking about Kurt Rambis and talking about Jim Clemens. So these things, which go beyond just the day-to-day coaching that Derek Fisher did, I think were real issues for Phil Jackson and for the Knicks organization. Now, where do they go from here? I think Kurt Rambis is going to get every opportunity to win this job outright. The Knicks have talent. Carmelo Anthony, talented. Kristaps Porzingis, talented. Guys on that roster, they should be able to make a run at a playoff spot in the Eastern Conference this year. And Kurt, who's been a coach in the past, has a history with Phil Jackson. If he can turn this thing around, maybe they give him an opportunity to keep the job full-time. As far as long-term goes, I think it's wide open right now. A lot of people have suggested that maybe Tom Thibodeau could get the job in New York. Look, Tibbs loves New York City. I've listed him as a potential candidate in Brooklyn. But can anyone really see a scenario where Tibbs and Phil Jackson coexist in a peaceful, long-term way? I mean, they're both smart people, two of the smartest coaches maybe we've ever seen in basketball, but they've got two entirely different coaching philosophies. Phil Jackson, he is a triangle savant, loves that offense. Tom Thibodeau, he is a hard-nosed, defensive-minded coach who cares mostly about that end of the floor. Now, you might say, can't they just blend these two styles together? And in theory, that would potentially work. But I just can't see Tibbs and Phil existing in that same type of situation. I just can't see it. I think the Knicks look elsewhere. Where that is, who knows? There are some very good coaching candidates out there. You've got Scott Brooks, who we just had on the podcast. He's a guy that I think deserves another opportunity to be a head coach somewhere. You've got a number of qualified assistant coaches that are out there. So there's a lot of possibilities for Phil Jackson to choose from. But I think what we have to understand with this situation is that this could be Phil Jackson's last stand. We've long said that we don't think Phil Jackson is going to be with this team for a decade. He is not going to be a Knicks lifer. What he could be is a short-term guy if this thing doesn't work out with the next coach. What happens if he fires a coach who fails to incorporate Kristaps Porzingis properly, who doesn't work well with Carmelo Anthony? Will Phil Jackson decide, you know what, I gave it a shot, I'd rather be in California. The Lakers might have a position for me. I'm going to go back to L.A. Could happen. Could happen at some point with Phil Jackson. So it's a very important hire for the Knicks president. Got to make the right decision. Got to make the right move. And really has to decide, is this team going to be one that's built around the triangle? Because if you're insistent on running the triangle offense, then you kind of limit the pool of candidates you can choose from, right? You can keep Kurt Rambis on the job. You can go get a Brian Shaw. There might be another assistant coach out there that will fall in line with what Phil Jackson wants to do. But I think you shallow the pool if you insist that the next head coach runs this triangle offense. Now, I can see the benefit of the triangle because Porzingis eventually is going to be a five, a guy that can step out and shoot the three, and I think could have a lot of success playing the triangle. But I don't think you want to limit yourself at this point if you're the Knicks with a head coach insisting that they run the triangle. So big decision for the Knicks coming up. Big time for Phil Jackson to make the right move with that organization. The other story I want to hit on real quick is something I wrote on the Vertical website earlier this week, and that is about the Sacramento Kings and what could be a very short relationship with head coach George Karl. In fact, George Karl could be gone by the time many of you hear this podcast. Now, firing George Karl, I think it would be in some ways warranted. You know, I've watched the Kings play recently. I saw them give 128 points against Brooklyn. I was live in Boston when they gave 128 points against the Celtics. When you have a team that is playing that poor defensively and seems that disinterested in playing on that end of the floor, sometimes you got to look at the coach's box and you got to make a change there. But make no mistake, the issues in Sacramento are not going to be resolved just by firing the head coach. It is so much deeper than that with the Kings. And it begins in ownership with Vivek Ranadive, a guy that I think needs to start behaving as a more, capable, sane type of owner for this team to be successful. Look, Ranadive bought this team. He saved them from moving. He is a hero in some ways in that Sacramento community. But he has been cycling through coaches in recent years, and that is a big problem for this Kings organization. You look at the successful teams across the NBA. What do they have in common? They've got continuity. Pat Riley and Eric Spoelstra, R.C. Buford and Greg Popovich, Sam Presti and before him Scott Brooks, now Billy Donovan. These tandems, these groups bunched together, they are successful because they grow together, because they get to know each other, and they have faith in each other. You need to have your owner believe that your GM is the best man for this job. You need your GM to believe that your head coach is the best man for this job. And it's never seemed like Sacramento has really had that. Whether it's Ranadive and Pete D'Alessandro, or now Vlade Divac and George Karl. Before that, it was Mike Malone. There has been so much turnover in Sacramento that you can't establish a winning culture. There are many things that need to be done in Sacramento. You've got to draft better. You've got to get some free agents that work with this mix. But above all else, you've got to establish some kind of winning culture. You've got to establish some consistency. Because right now, the Kings are more likely than not to be on the lookout for a future head coach or the next head coach sometime this offseason. And when you look around, if you're a top-flight coach like a Tom Thibodeau or a Scott Brooks, if you're one of those guys who is going to have options in the offseason, when you look at Sacramento, what motivates you to want to go there? Is it money? You can get money at a lot of places. Would you rather work for Sacramento or one of the teams in New York or maybe somewhere else? Or a Laker team? There are so many other teams that seem more stable than the Sacramento Kings. And I'm telling you, coaches look at this stuff. They take this stuff seriously. They look at their next job as a 4+ year commitment. They don't want to be looking over their shoulder and wondering if they're going to get fired, if they have a rough stretch, or if they don't agree necessarily with something the GM says. These are things that Sacramento needs to fix now before they go out and hire the next head coach. I think you can have success in Sacramento. You're going into a new arena. You've got a franchise linchpin in DeMarcus Cousins. But you've got to establish an identity and some consistency and a winning culture there first. As long as things are going the way they're going right now for Sacramento, you're not going to get top flight talent to want to sign there, and you're not going to get some of the top shelf coaches to want to go there. You're going to wind up with a head coach that's got very limited options. You're going to get the best of the rest, basically, after the top level coaches and assistant coaches wind up going somewhere else. That is something that can be changed from an ownership and a management perspective. I actually think that Vlade Divac, down the line, could turn out to be a pretty good general manager. But there is a reason that the top teams in the NBA have GMs that have been around for decades. Pat Riley, Sam Presti, R.C. Buford. These guys are basketball lifers. They're workaholics. And if you're going to hire Vlade Divac, you better hire a staff of 5 or 6 guys around him that are going to be able to teach him things and really educate him on how to become a successful GM. Vlade is... icon might be too strong a word, but he's certainly a big star in Sacramento from his playing days. He's a smart guy, no question about that, and a very easy guy to get along with, but he needs some help in that organization. He needs experienced hands within that organization to help him become a better GM, or else we're going to see Sacramento in the same quagmire they've been in for the last couple of years. That's it for this week's podcast. Make sure you check out the Vertical Podcast with JJ Redick and the Vertical Podcast with Woj. We'll be back with you here next week on the Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix.
This has been a digital media production. Find your voice. Find your voice.